from the heartland of America and the gateway to the West. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, a look into the future. Here's what's happening. First, though, I want to really thank my colleagues, Jimmy Church, Connie Willis, and Lisa Garr, for holding down the Coast to Coast Fort Friday, Saturday, and Sunday while I was in Laughlin, Nevada at a major conference, well received, by the way. But it was during this conference that the tragedy in Paris happened, and I made that announcement to the crowd that they simply gasped. They couldn't comprehend just how serious, how sad that situation is. France, they say, is committed to destroying the so-called Islamic State group after Friday's deadly attacks, according to its president. He said that he would table a bill to extend the state of emergency declared after the attacks for 3 months and would suggest changes to the constitution. France's military campaign against ISIS in Iraq and Syria will also intensify, he says. ISIS says it carried out the attacks on the bars, restaurants, a concert hall, and a stadium in which 129 people died. We thought at the time much more, but that number will go up as many people were critically injured as well. Jerry Corsi, part of WND.com and noted author and researcher, is with us, and Jerry will stay with us for the rest of this half hour. Jerry, where were you Friday when you received word on this horrible situation?
Well, George, I was had just basically finished a meeting in New York and was headed back to New Jersey. And when I got back to New Jersey, it was all on the television news. It was shocking, of course. And it's one of those incidents that kind of reframes everything. When you heard the attack had gone on in Paris and the horrific nature of the attack, it was a game-changing kind of realization that ISIS is operative and lethal in Paris, which is a dramatic expansion of the reach of this terrorist organization, and very frightening. So Friday evening, I watched the news until about 1 a.m., and then again began all weekend to follow it.
You know, I realized Friday after hearing and seeing this, we all went to CNN and started watching, Jerry, what was going on. Just how tragic this world really is. And in this particular case, of course, though it's magnified by a number of times worse than what we see in theaters and malls when young people are shot up or people are shot and murdered by a lone gunman who then ends up committing suicide or is killed by law enforcement, this was obviously coordinated with at least eight people. Seven of whom apparently blew themselves up with belts. I'll be talking with psychiatrist Peter Bregan in a moment about the mindset of somebody to do that. But what this shows me is that the situation here is a game changer, as you've said, where ISIS will continue its thuggery and simply try to get into countries. You don't need a lot of people to do what happened Friday in Paris, do you?
That's the problem. It's very much what the military strategists would call asymmetric warfare. Very few people can cause an enormous amount of carnage. And, George, it's clear that the attack in Paris was a coordinated attack. It was planned. It was timed. The assailants knew what their objectives were. That makes it all the more horrific, especially in a state like France, where there's always been a general assumption of a peaceful society. It's not an armed society, and in fact, when you look at the concert hall and these other venues, they're really gun-free kind of venues that unfortunately play right in the hands of a lone gunman who is the only one with a weapon and can basically kill at will. And the horrific nature of the way people were slaughtered, especially in that concert hall, makes it clear that we're all at risk to a lone gunman in a situation where there is no one armed, and targets are vulnerable because it's very difficult to protect every target, especially in a society like France or Paris, where the assumption has been of a peaceful society.
Jerry, you just stay where you are. We're going to come right back to you after the break and continue chatting with you down to the half hour point. The Paris terror attacks, of course, may have put a clamp on President Obama's plans to resettle 10,000 Syrian refugees over the next year, as the number of governors in their states saying they don't want to take them, and that number continues to grow. This is a sad, tragic story where these refugees, most of them, are homeless. But I would agree with the governors. You just can't let these people in if some of these terrorists and thugs are going to leak their way into the United States. It's unfortunate, but you just can't let them in. What we should be doing as a nation and as a world is eradicating ISIS and these thugs, so these Syrian refugees can go back to their homeland and have a life again. And that hasn't happened. Frosty Wooldridge, of course, author of America on the Brink, the next added 100 million Americans. Frosty, I am sure you will agree with me that, sadly, we cannot let these Syrian refugees into the country.
We can't, George. And it's now becoming very apparent that just in the last 3 days, first of all, four governors of the states decided to not take any refugees from Syria, and now it's 25 governors. This is starting to snowball. And one of the reasons, and I'm quoting James Comey, the director of the FBI, he told Congress, and I quote, "It's impossible to vet those refugees," unquote. And so, because that's a fact, more and more governors are saying, we're going to not allow any Syrian refugees or otherwise into our states. And the phone lines are burning off the hook. I couldn't get into Denver, Colorado, to tell my governor all day today because more and more Americans, certainly out here in Colorado where I live, were calling the governor's office saying no Syrian refugees in Colorado. I suspect that's happening throughout the country right now. And my bet is from 25 governors, it'll probably go to 35 governors, and pretty soon you're going to have a snowball effect, and the American people are going to stand strong against Obama and the Syrian refugee program, and I think it's going to be a national calling. The same things happened over in Europe just over the weekend. 70,000 Polish patriots marched in Poland saying, "Poland for Poles, and we don't want any immigrants." So this is starting to become a national issue. The American people and certainly the Europeans are saying enough of this. And I'm excited about that because it means we are starting to pull together as a country and taking action.
And I've got to tell you, though, Frosty, it is a very sad decision to make because I do believe that most of these refugees from Syria are just heartwarming people who want to get out of a very sad, tragic situation. But the problem is you just don't know who you're letting in.
And that's exactly correct, George. There's no way to vet them. And in fact, I'm doing some research on this today. Former U.S. Army intelligence officer Peach Hedseth, his name is Hedseth, said, and I quote, "The American people haven't begun to wrap their arms around this Islamic threat," unquote. Well, they're starting to wrap their arms around it because it's sheer numbers. If you take in more and more Muslims, you're going to have more and more radicalized Muslims. And as innocent as all these Syrian refugees are, all you need is 100 or 200 or 300 of them, and they could pull off the same kind of coordinated attacks since they're so trained in warfare and guerrilla warfare. They could pull off those attacks in any of our cities across America because we're such an open society. So this is a double threat, and that's why Americans don't want to have these Syrian refugees in our country just because of our own safety.
I understand. Frosty, thank you so much. And this situation, of course, is not just radical Muslims. It is deeper than that. It is an ideology of people who hate, of people who are bitter, of people who just want to eradicate others. I've got to tell you, folks, I know a lot of people who practice the Islamic faith. They are dedicated, loving people that I would trust with my life. As a matter of fact, one of them is my doctor in St. Louis, who one day saved my life. These are great people. The problem is you've got a handful, a multiple percentage of people who just are insane. They hate, they're bitter. And when Jerry joins me in a moment, we're going to get to the bottom of who's supplying them with weapons. Where are they getting their money? Who's forcing them to do this? Who's pushing them to do this? Dr. Peter Breggin, of course, is our resident psychiatrist. One of his books, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And Peter, I want to ask you a couple quick questions. One, of course, is the mother of one of these thugs said that he was stressed, and she believes that's the reason he did what he did and blew himself up. What kind of an excuse is that?
Well, it's none at all, George. You know, we really don't know why one individual or another individual unleashes the most violent aspects of human nature. But we do know some very, very important things, as in the case of the Paris attackers. We have a pretty good idea about what they get out of it and what encourages it. And that's what goes along with what a lot of what your guests are saying tonight. ISIS makes these people feel like warriors of a god rather than hateful people with meaningless lives. It makes them feel powerful instead of helpless, provides them a group identity. These are highly organized efforts with a lot of group cohesion. So it makes them have a group identity instead of loneliness. And instead of being afraid of death, it guarantees going to heaven. And I think ISIS is a perfect storm for bringing out the worst in people.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, you think, what would really possess somebody to go into a concert hall, kill innocent people, and then blow themselves up? It makes no sense. And Peter, one more question then. My other concern is, of course, what is happening worldwide, whether it's on social networking or television or the radio, and that's people being concerned about this happening here or in their own country, and people are uptight. Is there anything we can do about that?
I think people should be politically active. I'm very glad to hear the governor's calling in and governor's saying, no, we're not going to take such a potentially dangerous group of people in. You know, we live our lives, like the French are saying, we got to go out there and keep living our lives to the best we can.
That's right.
But we've got to give up the illusion that you can win over a group of violently organized people with an ideology, with a lot of religious principles that they can find to support their ideology, and who want to create a world dominated by their views. We have to give up being naive about that. There is, I think, nothing to be done except to stop ISIS.
Thank you, Peter. Stay on standby for the rest of the week for us, if you would. Believe it or not, there is other news. El Nino, the weather event, is expected to gain in strength before the end of the year. According to the World Meteorological Organization, its latest update, they say that in 2015 will be one of the three strongest recorded El Niños since 1950. El Niños bring severe droughts, significant flooding in many parts of the world. The droughts in California are horrible. It's been raining all day in St. Louis. We need to balance that out a little bit. Story at coasttocoastam.com, absolutely amazing. A volunteer firefighter badly burned in a 2001 blaze has received the most extensive face transplant ever, covering his skull and much of his neck. The surgery took place in August at the NYU Medical Center. The patient, a 41-year-old, is still undergoing physical therapy at the hospital, plans to return home to Mississippi in time for Thanksgiving. The surgery has paved the way for him to regain normal vision. In an interview last week, he said that, well, this will let him accomplish a major goal. He wants to start driving again. The donor was a 26-year-old New York artist and competitive bicyclist who died of injuries from a biking accident on a Brooklyn street. The story at coasttocoastam.com and the face transplant picture. Apple will open its first retail store in Singapore, which will also be Southeast Asia's first to be powered solely by solar energy. And how about this? You come home to your apartment and see some zombie asleep on your couch. You wake him up. Hey, what are you doing here? And he attacks you with a knife. That's exactly what happened in Denver. Nobody's hurt. But they got the guy who was just stone drunk. Okay, in a moment, Jerry Corsi joins us to the bottom of the hour as we continue about this tragedy in Paris. And then Randall Bell joins me as we talk about just incredible things to do to avoid life disasters. I'm really looking forward to that. He'll be with us for an hour and a half. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, and Jerry Corsi, of course. He received his Ph.D. in political science from Harvard University. He is a regular contributor here of Coast to Coast, and of course, he is a noted author. His books you can find on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com with his website, and he writes and researches for WND.com, Joseph Ferrer's excellent website. Jerry, in the minutes we have left, let me ask you a couple questions here. One, where are they getting their money? Where are they getting their weapons?
Well, ISIS has a lot of sources of money in the Middle East. Oil is one source, sale of antiquities, criminal activity, demanding ransom for kidnapped victims. They tax the population that they control. There's outside funding, but outside funding has been replaced by ISIS acting more and more as a criminal government of sorts, operating largely in Iraq and parts of Syria. So there is money, George, and the weapons, obviously, that were in the attack in Paris were funded, as were cars and communication equipment. ISIS is very active on social media. There was broadcasting of the event before it happened, with ISIS supporters sharing images of the Eiffel Tower and weapons on social media, something like 72 hours before the Paris attack, with messages, God bless you on your mission. So this was an internationally organized attack, and it was obviously funded.
What about Saudi Arabia funding this? Because I find it ironic there are no terror plots in Saudi Arabia.
Well, Saudis have funded the Wahhabis, a very aggressive, radical form of Islam, for decades. The Saudis are not in league at this point with ISIS. ISIS is so radical, it has threatened even the more stable states like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has a very tenuous relationship even with the Wahhabis. They continue to fund them, placate them. But Saudi Arabia itself does not want extreme radical Islam to be dominant in Saudi Arabia. So ISIS is a threat, even though ISIS is Sunni and so is Saudi Arabia, the same sect of Islam. Saudi Arabia is very uncomfortable with the dominance of ISIS and very concerned about its violence.
One thing that concerns me, Jerry, is many months ago we saw members of ISIS in Iraq, on miles and miles of road, in Humvees and trucks, waving their flag, and not one jet fighter, not one Apache helicopter took them out. I found that to be the strangest thing I've ever seen. Why not?
Well, George, I think we commented at the time, it was pretty bizarre. I mean, the streams of vehicles that were obviously in the open in Iraq could easily have been attacked by air. Had the United States at this time been maintaining a strong air presence to attack ISIS, the Obama administration has had kind of an on-again, off-again enthusiasm for attacks on ISIS, even air attacks. I think the most consistent air attacks we're going to see right now are from Russia. But the problem was we allowed ISIS to gain a foothold in Iraq, and now ISIS is a dangerous force controlling much of Iraq, and it's going to be difficult to remove ISIS without troops on the ground. It's going to be difficult to see how it could be done entirely by air.
Jerry, two factions of ISIS in Syria. There's one faction that we seem to support and give arms to because we want them to take out Bashar Assad, and then there's another force that seems to be friendly to Assad.
Well, and George, this goes back
to
arguments that have been going. It is bizarre. I mean, the arguments have been going on for several years now, and in the Obama administration, the arguments go on, saying there could be radical groups opposing Assad in Syria that the United States ought to support with weapons, and we have done this from time to time, and the weapons then end up in the hands of radical jihadists. It was the same thing that we did in Libya when, you know, Secretary Clinton and President Obama decided to support the militia who were affiliated with Al-Qaeda at this time in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi.
It is a strange situation. Jerry, we'll be following up with you all week long on this story. Tragedy in Paris, of course, that happened on Friday. And, of course, you know, is it going to happen here? That's the big question. Up next, Randall Bell joins us. We're going to talk about avoiding life disasters. Go figure. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And here we are, and in a moment, Randall Bell joins me. We're going to talk about avoiding life disasters. He's got an incredible series of things to talk with us about, and you know what? There's a great time to do that as well. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Our special guest tonight has worked for 25 years consulting on tragedies around the world, including the 9/11 World Trade Center attack, the Bikini Atoll nuclear testing disaster, the Heaven's Gate mass suicides, you remember that case, and the O.J. Simpson case and others as well. Randall Bell is a Ph.D. in Human Organizational Systems from Fielding Graduate University and an MBA from UCLA. Dr. Bell is a socioeconomist and the CEO of Landmark Research Group. And his book is Rich Habits, Rich Life, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. We're going to talk about avoiding disasters, and what a perfect time to get you on, Randall. But thank you for joining us.
George, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You have been called the Master of Disaster and Dr. Disaster. How'd you get those nicknames?
At first I resented it. I think the first thing came up when the LA Times did a profile on my career years ago, and I picked up the paper off the drive when I came in, and I said to my wife, I'm called the Master of Disaster here. It's the very first sentence of the article. I said, you can just call me Master for short, and that didn't go so well. But then the Wall Street Journal called me Dr. Disaster. People magazine called me Ghostbuster. I've never seen a ghost. But at first, I kind of fought this trend, and then I decided to go with it. And I even had some T-shirts made up to give out to kids when I speak at high schools and that kind of thing.
When I was a television producer back in 1974 in Detroit, they used to call me Captain Bizarre because I loved using strange stories. And look at me now. But they did that. So those phrases stick, but sometimes they're worthwhile to be sure.
Yeah.
You have worked on disasters, but what does that mean that you've worked on some of these disasters? What do you do for them?
Well, I get called in on, it seems like, virtually every major disaster and lots of smaller disasters that don't hit the news. In primarily out of my background as an economist, appraisers measure value. I measure loss and value. So when you hear on the news that this disaster cost, you know, $17 billion, I'm the guy that actually computed that number.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a long time ago, George, that, you know, behind the statistics are people. And so really to get a full sense of what's going on, you have to look at the behaviors behind the people and what can be done to mitigate that damage and try to get that number down.
Randall, had you been in France during this tragedy, would you have been called in on an episode like that?
Very well could be, but fortunately for me, because I'm not really drawn to the, I don't like seeing the horrific, you know, scenes that these cause. They make me feel very, very sad, as I'm sure most people. I'm usually called in months or even years later. Like with the World Trade Center, I was actually called in 5 years after 9/11.
Five years?
The timing varies.
Why'd they wait so long to call you?
Well, because in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, you want to, people like me want to stay out of the way and let the first responders, you know, get and do what they can. There's a lot of police activity, a lot of security things. They don't get to the number crunching and the economics and the long overall strategies that I develop until, you know, that's all kind of, that phase kind of goes away.
Randall, tell me, how does this apply to all of us as individuals who have on the outside witnessed these tragedies? And then I'm going to ask you about some of the people on the inside. But, you know, Friday, for example, I was in Laughlin, Nevada. I had a major speech and conference to attend. And we were getting tidbits of this horrid story breaking in Paris. And then, of course, we got the full details. 9/11, my daughter woke me up. I had gotten off the air late in St. Louis and
early that day, my daughter was calling me saying, "Dad, you got to turn on the TV. A plane just hit the World Trade Center." And then the second one hit. So I, like so many other Americans and Canadians listening to you right now, Randall, we have been witnesses on the outside. How does this affect us?
Well, it affects me the same way as it affects anyone else, even though I'm around it on a day-to-day basis. I've worked on hundreds of these cases. I mean, there's no easy way around it. When I went to New York, I give a lot of speeches myself, as I know you do, and I happened to be in New York a few days after 9/11. I was surprised my clients still wanted me to come, but I did.
Yeah.
And, when I went downtown to Ground Zero, I'm big enough to admit it, I got very choked up, and you wouldn't be human not to be. It was horrifically emotional. I still remember that, and that's just the emotions that play out in any sensible human's, system. And there's that process of, surprise and grief and denial and all those phases that psychologists talk to us about. And I think a lot of us, certainly me, goes through the same processes of just being shocked by what we see in France and all these disasters.
What we saw in Paris over the weekend and on Friday, I think, is pure murder. There's no rhyme or reason for what they do. This was hatred. This was bitterness. This wasn't even in the names of religion, for crying out loud, because religions don't push this. Believe me, it's the fanatics in the radicals who are pushing this. But this was pure murder, and I don't get what they get out of this. This is not a cause. This is not war where you can look at someone in a uniform who are occupiers or whatever. It's not like World War II. When you look at these kinds of disasters, and I know I'm pushing the envelope a little bit with you on this because you're primarily on the other side, but what possesses these people to murder like that?
It's a great question, and the best answer I can come up with it is brain chemistry and endorphins and that kind of thing. Hatred is a very, it's a very, very strong emotion. It secretes endorphins into the bloodstream, and they're, frankly, they're addictive. And we get into these patterns of hatred. We need more and more of those endorphins to feed that high. I mean, I guess a healthier example of that would be watching horror movies or that kind of thing, where people, get kind of a buzz off, the scary, mean, angry endorphins that the brain secretes. But these people have obviously become, grossly addicted to absolutely fanatical levels in their addiction for hatred and meanness. And it's sad. I don't have a better explanation than that.
Now, we've been talking about huge disasters that all of us witness and see and hear. But there are also smaller disasters, personal disasters, which are just as important to individuals, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we see the big ones, the iconic disasters that we're talking about and that I've worked on a number of them. But, behind all of these are people. And what's interesting is that I get to meet, access to these very interesting places. I meet the people that we read about in the on the headlines, and their reactions are identical to the person down the street that's going through the death of a child or a divorce or some difficult situation, and it's those emotions, frankly, are virtually identical between the big ones and the people in our everyday neighborhoods.
The title of your book I find interesting, From Rich Habits, Rich Life, to also the subtitle, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. So, corner stories of all great pursuits. So, tell me what you mean by rich habits, rich life.
Well, George, as I'm kind of advancing towards retirement, I've decided I don't want to retire. I've had this privilege of working on these cases, literally all 50 states, all 7 continents, where I've been to sites of disaster, tragedy, controversy, and so forth. And I think I have a responsibility to document some positive lessons out of this, and at least for myself and at least for my kids and anybody else who wants to take a look at this. I think there's just been too much in the way of, as I say, it's been a privilege to research this for decades, And I think there's too many important lessons that really have to be documented. And I think they're positive lessons. I mean, we've shifted, you know, dramatically from talking about disasters to, you know, a rich and fulfilling life. But that's really what it's all about, because I've been able to get kind of a front row pass to seeing people that go through a disaster, but they go through a process that I've come to call post-traumatic thriving. They've been really kicked in the teeth, and yet they've come out on top. They've done something really remarkable, and it's as if the disaster woke them up from some dormant state and made them accomplish greater things than they would have had they not been through the disaster in the first place. And I want to document those important lessons.
And the four cornerstones of all great pursuits. What are four cornerstones?
Well, it's four simple words. I wanted a formula that kids could understand, but the CEOs and the multimillionaire and billionaire clients that I have, that they would respect it. The four cornerstones are me, we, do, be. And in a nutshell, George, me are skills that develop our thinking, our level of wisdom intellectually, philosophically, spiritually. Those are all me cornerstone habits and rituals and routines. We are those cornerstones that build relationships. Do our cornerstone habits that build productivity financially, physically, environmentally. And then be our habits and routines that build the future. And that's the exact same process I went through with the World Trade Center, with the OJ case, with all these cases. Those are the four cornerstones that we discuss in the boardrooms as we work through these problems.
Yeah, tell me, how did you work on the OJ case? What did you do there?
Well, Lou Brown happens to live very close to where I live, actually a few blocks away. And, you know, with any disaster, and this one's no exception, the Brown family was going through both horrific emotional, you know, stress with the trial and you know, the murder and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But there were also practical issues, and Lou needed to know what to do with the condo where Nicole had been murdered. He listed it for a premium, and he asked me for advice, of which I gave him. I went and studied the situation, and I came back to him, and I said, look, the strategy is, it's going to be very difficult to sell the condo while the trial is going on. And by the way, you know, even though the property's famous, doesn't mean it's more valuable. We're going to have to take a discount. And so I computed that information for him and put together a strategy, and we eventually were successful in getting the property sold.
Interesting. I know I had a friend of mine who owned a haunted house that some noted Hollywood people had passed away in. Or another owned the Charlie Chaplin house, and he sold it for a pretty good profit. It's interesting how you could price those.
Yeah, it's all a matter of research and data, and fortunately in our office we have literally thousands of case studies of crime scenes, a mass suicide, environmental contamination, where we can really draw on those case studies and really get a pretty good picture of what to expect with these disasters as they come along.
And as you got into this, how did you get into this?
It's funny. Well, truthfully, I was floating in the pool one weekend.
Preferably back looking up, not face down, right?
I was fortunately looking up on my back, and I was going to start law school the next day. And I thought, you know what? I don't know, the world needs another attorney. And I it was like an epiphany in the pool as I was floating, thinking if I took my skill sets with real estate and valuation and economics and finance, and I measure losses, I could really document that. And so that's what I did. I called all my clients, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, everyone, and I said, for now on, don't send me any real estate appraisals or consultations or financial analyses unless it's damaged. And George, I got to tell you, my timing was perfect, because there was the Northridge earthquakes, the Malibu fires, there was OJ, Southern California went through this whole blitz of problems, the LA riots, and I was just loaded up from work from that day till today.
For an individual, a personal crisis or tragedy is as big as 9/11 to them, isn't it?
It really is. The emotions are exactly the same, and while, you know, we all saw what happened with the OJ and the family there, and I got to, you know them quite well. In fact, I was just at the Brown home a couple weeks ago, sitting around the kitchen table. Their emotions are identical to the obscure case you don't read about, where someone lost a child or you know, horrific accident. The emotions are identical.
I'm amazed that You talk about strange karma. O.J. still in jail over his memorabilia episode. Isn't that bizarre?
I think it's terrific.
No. He was acquitted. He was acquitted. Don't forget.
Well, I'm not bashful about saying that I personally believe that O.J. committed the murders. I think it's pretty obvious. And I think that it is karma. I think what goes around comes around, and that's interesting about this, you know, psychology of a sociopath, because if you identify sociopathic behavior, all you do is get away. They will self-destruct on their own, and that's exactly what happened with O.J.
Now, that's an interesting take, too. What is the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
Great question. The answer is this. Both of them are nicknames. The proper term is antisocial personality disorder, but that's a very long term that even I, who have been through the training, have a difficult time remembering. Sociopath is a nickname for you know, antisocial personality disorder, and it's easier to just say sociopath. Psychopath is also a nickname, but it's something a lot more extreme. So a sociopath example would be someone who runs a charity scheme, or someone who habitually lies, you know, Dr. Martha Stout out of Harvard, she said, interesting statistic, 1 out of 24 people on this planet is an everyday sociopath. In other words, they habitually lie, and they get kind of a buzz off lying and deceiving others. But a psychopath is someone more extreme. They tend to be more violent. You were talking more about the murders and the rapists and the things that are really, you know, horrific.
See, but they both hurt in different ways. They hurt people in different ways, don't they?
You're absolutely right. And I was having lunch with Denise Brown a couple years ago, and she explained something to me that really was interesting. She said, she'd been on a crusade, and I helped her with it to help battered women. She said, you know, when someone's hit, the bruise heals up. The physical damage heals up in a week or two or three. But emotional damage can last months, years, or a lifetime. It's much more damaging to be damaged emotionally than it is physically. And you got to keep that in perspective. I thought it was an interesting perspective she provided there.
I think so, too. We're going to take phone calls with you, Randall, next hour from people who have gone through disasters, or they just might have questions here for you. But in the next 5 years, I'm predicting that we will go through some incredibly tense, horrendous times. I have been saying for 2 years now that I'm sensing things are happening, and things seem to be unfolding like that. I think we're right at the tip of the iceberg. How do we get through that?
I think it was a good, strong psychology, and we don't have control. By the way, I hope you're wrong, but I think you're right.
I'm wrong, and I think I'm right too.
And I'm ready to retire, so I wish disasters would go away. But the answer is we can't control these things that are going on in France. They're very, very, very maddening. They're very, very sad. We can't control global economies and weather patterns. The only thing we can really control, when you think about it, is our daily habits, rituals, and routines. We control what time we get up. We control what we put in our mouths. We control our thoughts. We control our behaviors. I can't even, you know, control my kids, you know, at all. I can only control myself. So I think
they're not easy. I raised three of them myself. They're
exactly.
Not easy.
So I think the thing we can control are those things, and that's what, you know, I try and get at with this book, is talking about our daily habits and routines to keep us healthy, our thinking healthy, our productivity healthy, our own relationships healthy, excluding the toxic people in our lives, drawing in the positive people, building our own personal futures the best we can. That's what we really have control over. Well, I think you're right. I think that, you know, there's not much we can do about that global situation. What we can do is really address our own behaviors and create a happy lives, you know, for ourselves and for those close to us.
All right, let's talk more about that when we come back, Randall. And I'm going to ask you the question, though we cannot stick our heads in the sand and pretend that all these other outside influences aren't happening, what do we do about that? And the phone lines are now open. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.